Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and today, as we have been going over the last several weeks, we're going to continue with the reading of the works of the Irish hunger striker Bobby Sands. His writings from prison, specifically One Day in My Life, which I've been going over the last several weeks, like episodically. And I'm going to continue with that today. Now, to recap, Bobby Sands was 27 years old and had been on hunger strike for 66 days when he died on May 5th, 1981. The young IRA volunteer was world famous by the time of his death, having spent the last 9 years of his short life in prison and had been elected while still a prisoner to the British Parliament. And the hunger strike was aimed at rebutting the British government's attempts to criminalize the struggle for Irish freedom by changing Sands and his fellow cellmate status from political prisoners to criminals. While behind bars, Sands wrote secretly on toilet paper and cigarette papers with the refill of a cheap pen that he kept hidden inside his body. These writings were then smuggled out of the prison. And with dry humor, they chart a man's attempt to preserve his identity against appalling beatings, unimaginable filth, freezing cold, and numbing boredom. In poetry and prose, he vividly evokes the enclosed hell of Long Kesh prison, the harassment and the humiliating invasive searches. And his writings from prison stand as a testament to the political prisoners' courage and their indomitable struggle for recognition and freedom. And of course, the reason why I started doing this was because of, at the beginning of this month, a Palestinian man, Hadar Adnan, died after 86 days on hunger strike. That was on May 2nd. And this really is in solidarity. The Irish struggle for liberation against British occupation has really been joined at the hip throughout its modern history with the Palestinian struggle for liberation. And this really is, this reading of Bobby Sands, his work, One Day in My Life, it really is in solidarity with the Palestinians on hunger strike against the Israeli apartheid system today. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Without further ado, I will begin. The afternoon was growing older, and the first tinges of worry began to cross my mind. Where was my visit? I sat listening and willing the phone at the top of the wing to ring to inform A that my visitors had arrived. I began stripping pieces of thread from one of my flimsy blankets and started to plait them together to pass the time, making a long line that hopefully would come in handy later. A skiff of snow fell in through the open window as another heavy fall threatened to follow once more. The afternoon light was beginning to fade, growing dimmer with each passing minute. The calling of the crows making their way home from the nearby fields came plainly on the slight evening breeze. I rose and stood at the window, watching the crows fade into the distance and the thousands of different colored lights illuminating their designated vicinity one by one as they were switched on. The entire area before my eyes was soon a mass of glittering, brilliant lights, causing the snow-covered wire to sparkle and glitter. The winter light of day died and darkness took over. It was getting very late, I thought, hiding the plaited line in a hole in my mattress and feeling the ever-increasing panic setting in more and more. I was wondering and speculating as to what could have happened to my visit. It must be at least 4:30 p.m., I thought. What has happened? The telephone rang. I stiffened my muscles, hoping to hear the long-awaited words. A was summoned by the screw at the top of the wing. That's it, I thought excitedly, and sat down impatiently waiting developments. The minutes dragged by, and still no indication to confirm that my visit had arrived. 5 minutes. Now 10 minutes. Then the rattle of keys and approaching footsteps. The warning rattle of the lock and the door opened. C and D stood there. "Visit, tramp," C rasped at me, hatred hanging on every syllable. If C had his way, I would be put up against the nearest wall to be shot. I rose from the mattress, pulling the blankets off me, letting them drop to the ground and wrapping a towel around me. I stepped out of the cell door into the urine-covered corridor of the wing. It was warmer in the corridor than it was in the cells. I noticed that immediately. I trod on through the river of urine until I reached the end cell where the prison garb was stored. Going on a visit was the only time that we donned the prison uniform. I glanced around me and grabbed the nearest set of clothing. I was just about to put the shirt on when D said, "Right, drop your towel and stand over by that mirror," pointing to a large mirror which lay on the floor. I did as he said. He told me to bend over and touch my toes. I refused. A was called and he entered the cell. All three of them proceeded to grab me and forcibly bend me over. A and D held me while C inspected my anus. After several seconds, they released their grip and I straightened myself and began to dress. Bastards, I said to myself. They didn't even ask me to open my mouth. They were not interested in searching me, but in humiliating me. I left the cell, dressed and disgusted, storing in the back of my mind the fact that they didn't search my mouth and reminding myself that the worst was yet to come. They locked me behind the steel grills at the top of the wing. I was a sorrowful-looking sight, dirty face, shaggy hair and beard, with a prison uniform that was several sizes too large hanging on me. I didn't give a damn. But the sooner I got it off me, the better, and to hell with my appearance. I was being tortured, not manicured. A screw came and opened the gate of the grill, whereupon another screw awaited to escort me on my visit. He led me out into the blacked-out transit van that sat outside the door of the yard, engine running and the exhaust smoke belching out underneath the back of it into the darkness. I shivered as I sat down upon the hard bench-like seat. I had been hoping that some of the lads from the other wings or blocks might be in the van going on a visit also, but it was empty and dark. My escorting screw climbed into the back of the van and closed the door, throwing the confines into total darkness. "Right," he shouted to the van driver, who immediately drove off. We passed out through the front gate of the H-blocks, the front gate of Hades, I thought to myself. The screw cursed the loose, rattling door and held it to stop it flying open. He tried to make conversation with me. "How long have you been on the blanket now?" he inquired and added immediately. "Don't you think you might as well be packing it in?" "No, I don't," I answered him dryly. "Yous aren't getting anywhere," he said matter-of-factly. "No one ever does until they reach what they've set out for," I said sharply. "You must be mad," he said. "I wouldn't do what you're doing if I were in your position." "I'm quite sure you wouldn't," I said. "Maybe that's because you're a screw and I'm a political prisoner." He didn't like that last remark, I thought, as he became very quiet in the darkness. I'm sure his face was red, I said to myself. "Besides," I said, putting the boot right in, "at the end of the day, you will be entitled to feel more let down than anyone." "How's that?" he muttered. "Well," I added, "when the British government, through the stroke of a political pen, grant political status to us again, or, better still, declare their intention to withdraw, which they might do all right when necessity forces them to, it's going to make a proper ass out of you. What are you going to do then?" "That won't ever happen," he said nervously. "It will happen all right," I said. "And better still, they've done it before, in places like Cyprus, Aden, and Palestine. Yes, they will most certainly do it again," I added, just for good measure, as the van came to an abrupt halt. He opened the door and stepped out, beckoning me to follow him. He wasn't so chirpy now, I noticed. It frightened the best of them. None of them relished the thought of being left high and dry, especially with the atrocities that they had committed, and still were committing, to be answered for. I passed by the search boxes that were doing a brisk trade on those returning from their visits. They were all remand prisoners and ordinary prisoners. The special search hut for the blanket men was set apart from all the others, looking sinister and evil. Patches of snow were clinging to the sides of its wooden structure, giving it a lonely, desolate appearance. But it was in operation, all right. A heavy, dull thud and a shout coming from its interior soon testified to that. I entered the visiting building and stood there in the bright light while the screw went to find out what visiting box I ought to be brought to. Dozens of screws eyed me up and down as they passed me by, making the occasional snide remark or jib at me. I ignored them. The bustle around me seemed unreal. I was unused to such a change in atmosphere. It was not the murderous, tension-filled atmosphere that surrounded and hung over me every day in the H-block. There were plenty of nasty screws here, all right, but they were concerned with other business, which, thank God, wasn't me for a change. The screw came back and led me to a large visiting room. "Box 7," he said. "Jesus," I thought. Box 7 is one of the end boxes where most of the prowling screws congregated. The screw opened the visiting room door and I walked into a large room. It was like walking into a play. The buzz of whispered conversation struck me first, then the clouds of smoke, the colorful clothing worn by the huddled little groups of visitors who hung over the tables in the open boxes whispering and muttering. The black mass of screws pacing up and down the floor, hanging over their shoulders, cracking jokes amongst themselves, and filling the air with their loudmouth laughter. I glanced at the numbering of the boxes, 12, 11, 10, 9, and made my way toward box 7. Friendly, sympathetic faces smiled encouragement at me from the open boxes. Old women, wives, daughters, sisters, and brothers, the children and fathers of my comrades. I smiled back as best I could, feeling more than sorrow and sympathy towards them. "God bless you, son," some old woman shouted at me, Keep your chin up, she added. I felt like crying. Move along, one of the screws snarled at me. In a daze, I scanned the boxes as I passed them by. My comrades and their families were smiling and calling to me. I turned into box 7 and, not thinking, sat down on the wrong side of the box. The prowling screws nearby nearly ate me. Get off that chair and get around to this side of the table, they snapped, seemingly competing with each other to see who could be the most dominant and nastiest. I changed sides. Bastards, I said to myself. How are you, son? Called some old fellow with a dairy accent as he passed by my box. I'm surviving, I said. Which is just about right and no more. Good for you, son, and God take care of every one of you, called another passerby, a middle-aged woman that sounded like a Tyrone accent. Some distance to travel, I thought, for a half-hour visit. The screws continued to prowl up and down, ever vigilant and listening to every word that was being spoken. 3 more, plus my escort, stood by the side of my box talking. 3 or 4 people came around the partition directly beside my box. Then my mother appeared, my father and sister following directly behind her. I stood up to greet them as they approached the visiting box. I saw my mother taking a quick glance around her a split second before she started to hug me. And then I felt her hand touch the side of the baggy coat that I was wearing. The congregation of screws were partially covered by the approach of my father and sister. Those prowling past the boxes had their backs turned. It was a quick move. I knew what it was, and I knew that it was now in my left-hand pocket. My sister had reached me and threw her arms around me while my father shook my hand at the same time. My eyes were scanning the faces of the screws for a telltale sign of discovery. There were none, but my heart stopped as they moved toward the box. My mother sat down, and I sat down beside her. My father and sister went around to the other side of the plain wooden table, which served as a division between prisoner and visitor. Right, shouted a screw. I nearly fell off the chair, discovery screaming at me from every side. You'll have to move away from the prisoner to the other side of the table, the screw said to my mother. My heart was pounding and a sickish feeling gripped my chest. I thought for several terrible seconds I had been caught. That just about would have made my day. Prisoner, my mother said, exasperated. That's my son. Surely I can sit beside my son. No, I'm afraid you can't, he said. That's right, you can't. Prison rules, another one chipped in. I was too busy regaining my composure from the awful fright to argue. My mother, fearing the loss of the visit, somewhat hesitantly moved her chair around the other side of the table beside my sister and father. The screws, having adamantly stood there to see their word decreed, now moved off, retreating a bare 3 feet from my visiting box, where they stood in a group talking in hushed voices and staring at us all the while. As I turned around in my chair, turning my back to them, and began talking to my family. How are you, son? My mother asked. I'm not too bad, Ma, I answered, seeing the anguish in her face as she examined my terrible appearance. Your beard has gotten a lot longer since I last saw you, my father said jokingly, and my sister began asking me, was it cold in the cells? My father took out a packet of cigarettes and gave me one. I took a light from the solitary match that they were allowed to bring in with them. My mother held my other hand in hers. I heard the shuffle of feet behind me. I was in no doubt the warders were watching my every move and weighing every word that was spoken. How are you all? I asked, adding that I thought the 3 of them looked grand. The cigarette was making my head light, but I had dreamed of this cigarette too bloody often to discard it. How was everyone else keeping, I asked, and listened eagerly to the answers. All 3 competed with each other to get talking. There was so much to be told and so many questions I had to have answered. It was one excited babble of conversation. We ignored our unwanted listeners and reduced our voices to barely audible whispers. When something arose that we did not want them to hear. I would have preferred them to hear nothing, but what could be done? My father and mother continually glanced towards them, but I knew that would not move them a single inch. My sister was telling me bits and pieces of news. I was trying to lodge them in my mind to tell the lads later, while at the same time struggling to remember other things I wished to ask them. My mother whispered to me to be careful with the small parcel in my pocket. She said that there was a little bit of tobacco squashed in as small as possible, cigarette papers, and a wee note from my sister Bernadette. My mind was in turmoil, collecting news, asking this and asking that. Such and such was dead or dying. Everyone seemed to be getting married. Soldiers wrecked the house again, and such's young son was charged. There were a lot of strikes brewing here, and England was plagued with them. It was in the papers about the flu epidemic, the forcible baths and haircut in the H blocks. There had been a Christmas tree on the Falls Road beside Dunville Park with all the blankets men's names on it. I was storing every scrap of information in my mind, and all the while thinking of the powder keg in my left-hand pocket. I gave them a quick rundown of things in the blocks, telling them to drop into the H Block Information Bureau on the Falls Road and tell them there what I had told them about Pee Wee O'Donnell, Liam Clark, and Sean Hughes, and what had occurred in this morning's wing shift. My beard was hiding the marks on my face that I received that morning, but my mother and sister were searching my hands and face for telltale signs of a beating and continually asking me, was I sure I was all right? I lit another cigarette from the one I was about to extinguish, feeling a lot more up to it now. The other visiting boxes were emptying rapidly. I could hear the people moving towards the exit door behind me. I did not look around. I'd seen it all before and didn't wish to see those sorrowful, pitiful faces again. My sister was telling me how her young son was doing. My mother followed that up with what was in last week's Republican News, and my father added to it. I gave them a few messages that I had for some of the lads' families, that they could pass on to them. I sat listening intently to how the parade went. My father interjected again to tell me of the growing interest and concern that was gathering in America, France, and other European countries over what was going on in the H Block. Our conversation continued, and I lit another cigarette. 12 minutes left, I noted, keeping an eye on my father's watch. Good luck to you boys, and God bless every one of you, a departing visitor shouted aloud to one and all. I became conscious of the fact that my unwashed body must be smelling, but I ignored it. As ever, no comment was forthcoming from my people. My sister was now telling me how things were in the district and who had been around in my mother's house inquiring about me and how her husband was keeping. My mother began to tell me about a recent riot in the district when a screw interrupted her. Right, that's it, time's up, he barked over my shoulder, handing the visiting permit to my mother, emphasizing that he wished her, my father, and sister to depart. There's still 8 minutes of my half hour left, I said coldly to him. Too bad, see the governor, was his aggravating reply. My mother and sister looked towards me anxiously. It doesn't matter, son. Sure, it's only a couple of minutes, my mother said, worried that I would reap the repercussions of an argument when they got outside the visiting area. I rose from the chair, knowing that the visit would be over no matter what I said. I was disgusted and angry, but I didn't wish to leave my family worrying. There was more than enough to worry over as it was. My mother and sister began hugging and kissing me goodbye, tears rolling down their cheeks, having suddenly appeared from nowhere. I was shattered. The screws were harassing me from behind. Come along, right, that's enough, come along. I'll see you next month, I said to my mother and sister, my father stealing a quick handshake just before the screws literally bundled me towards the exit door for prisoners. I caught a glimpse of the remaining little huddled groups whispering amongst each other around the little tables. In some of the boxes, a screw sat right beside the visitor. These were the notorious appeal visits. One word out of place not pertaining to the appeal case, and the watchdog screws sprang upon you and terminated the visit. I caught a final glimpse of my family as they waved goodbye before the screw almost slammed the door in my face. Right, you, he roared. Wait there. He was not my original escort, who had apparently disappeared. But it looked like I was stuck with this bastard who had now gone off to check me out of the visit. I stood there shaking a little, feeling disoriented and somewhat sick, being unused to being out of my small, stinking, concrete tomb-like cell. The sight of other people with smiles to offer, friendly, sympathetic faces, colorful expressions and clothes, the comfort of simply seeing my family again was just too much for my physically wrecked body and tortured mind to cope with or adapt to. There was a bustle of activity going on around me. Screws all over the place. Jesus, Mary, and Holy Saint Joseph, the wee parcel. I worked my hand, in panic, to the other side of my coat. It was still there. I could feel it. I glanced around, and when it looked good, I put my hand to my pocket and took it out. A screw passed me, eyeing me up and down. I held the wee parcel like a bomb. It was concealed in my fist. I was praying that the screw who was escorting me wouldn't come back now. All clear. I made my move. Like a flash, it was up and out of my hand and into my mouth. It was fairly small and wrapped in stretch and seal plastic. I gazed at the window in front of me, looking at my reflection. My beard hid any telltale bulge. I would just have to sweat it out now. Other screws came walking past me, their searching, probing eyes glaring at me as if I were something out of the ordinary. But then I was, I thought, staring at my reflection in the window again. My uncombed hair ruffled and shaggy, and my long beard untamed and wild like a bramble bush. And from somewhere in between, ghostly white and, dare I say, somewhat frightening, appeared my own face. Rugged and aged before its time. My cheeks and eyes were sunken and withdrawn into my face, creating a hollow from where my glassy, piercing eyes stared back at me. An unseen, covered by the prison garb, stood my dilapidated, physically wrecked body. "Right, you, move along," came that growling bark again, interrupting my thoughts and self-scrutiny, setting me in motion towards the search huts that stood outside. I passed by the first hut, where the ordinary prisoners were frisked, searched, and then the second hut, where the remand prisoners were dealt with in a similar fashion. The third hut, which I only knew only too well, sitting apart from everything else and looking drab, desolate, and sinister, was the special hut, where only we were taken, the blanket men, the Republican prisoners of war. My escorting screw, as ever behind, barked another command. "Right, you, in there." I could hardly swallow my spittle with the parcel in my mouth. I detected the eagerness in his voice. He could hardly wait to get me inside. He almost threw me in through the door. The inside of the search hut was as drab as the outside. Several screws stood warming their hands over an oil-fueled fire. It was cold outside. A coating of snow still lay on the ground. Panic was rising in me as each of them glared at me, and, as was only to be expected, at my face. I was waiting on the fatal words, "What's that in your mouth?" But they never came. I stood there for an eternity, my eyes scanning the room. The inside was a lot warmer than the stinking, freezing tomb I was used to. A few chairs were scattered about the room. A plastic basin filled with a blue-colored disinfectant sat upon the oil fire, where a stack of paper towels lay adjacent to it. And upon the floor, and looking out of place, was a large mirror secured to a wooden handle. The screws began to mill around me, battens dangling at their hips. For some stupid reason, I thought of a dental surgery. I don't know why, as any dentist that I've ever encountered was considerate. "Right, tramp," snapped a harsh voice. "Strip." I stripped, standing naked before them. They stood around, glaring at my naked body. I was embarrassed and humiliated, but I couldn't grasp the full significance of it. The humiliation was secondary to my parched throat, the potential bomb in my mouth, and the thoughts churning around in my mind of what lay ahead of me. So, more so if I had to spit out contraband. Jesus, I thought. What they had to do to us to discover and catch the odd love letter from one of the lad's sweethearts, the worrying note from a distracted mother, the lousy, meager little parcel of tobacco. It was just pure torture and harassment. "Turn around," growled another bully screw. I turned, making a full circle. Panic gripped me as they scrutinized my body. I was awaiting the fatal command every second. "Open your mouth." "Turn around again," snapped the screw who was escorting me. That's it, I thought. They're really rubbing this humiliation bit in. If I had been able to speak, I would have told them that they had humiliated me enough, and any more humiliating to be done, they could do it. They had forced me to degrade myself enough already. I stood silent and still. He threatened me and yelled his command once more. I ignored it. I thought the roof had fallen upon them. They were momentarily dumbstruck, so startled that they just stood staring at me in utter disbelief that I had disobeyed their word. Their faces were flushed and perplexed. Anger was building up inside them. "Here it comes," I told myself. "Here it bloody well comes." "Get up against that wall and spread eagle," one of them finally mumbled, breaking the seemingly eternal silence. I remained unintimidated, but not unperturbed. I was shaking, and it wasn't from the cold. I was scared stiff, frightened to the verge of panic. I thought I was about to vomit up the parcel on the floor. They grabbed my arms and threw me up against the wooden wall. The impact made a dull thud. They held me in a spread eagle fashion. Someone punched me in the ribs and my feet were kicked apart my legs. A terrible pain tore through my outstretched arms and my already aching, bruised body hurt all the more. They continued to hack at my ankles with their heavy-issue boots, constantly screaming and shouting, cursing and threatening me. I felt the cold, chamfered edges of the large mirror being pushed between my legs. They were scrutinizing my anus, using the mirror to afford a view from every angle. A foreign hand probed and poked at my anus, and, unsatisfied, they kicked the back of my knees, forcing me down into a squatting position, where they again used the mirror, and to finish off, they rained more kicks and blows on my naked, burning body for good measure. I fell to the floor, which was wet and dirty from the melted snow, carried into the hut on their boots. I rose immediately, half conscious of the pains as they streaked through my body. I made a desperate attempt to swallow my spittle, and not only did I almost choke on the parcel, but I almost spat it out on the floor. My face was contorted and red as I fought to hold back a cough. I grabbed the clothing I had been wearing and dressed as quickly as I could, racing to get finished before they finished washing their sadistic hands in a basin of disinfectant. "Maybe that'll help you find your tongue," rasped one of them, drying his hands with a paper towel. Jesus, I thought, the very mention of anywhere in that vicinity made me panic. I raced to dress. A hand from behind lifted my hair to see if there was anything hidden behind my ears. I panicked and almost made a move to switch the wee parcel from my mouth to a pocket, which they wouldn't search again, but the searching hand withdrew to a vacant space that had just appeared around the disinfectant basin. Clothes half hanging off me, I realized just how sore I was. I struggled towards the door, my growling companion of a screw falling in behind me. I stepped through the door waiting on, "Where are you going to? We're not finished." But again, nothing happened. My throat was burning. The fresh air hit me, refreshing me and reviving me a little. A few of the lads from the other block stood there, their faces white as ghosts, as white as the snow they stood upon, awaiting their turn, no doubt having heard the yells and thuds of my fate and knowing only too well that it was to be their fate next. "Okay, Bobby?" one of the lads asked. I couldn't answer. I nodded in recognition and sympathy, thinking of where they were going, and took consolation from the relieving fact that at least I had the torturous ordeal behind me. I trudged onward toward the H block. There was no van about, and I was only too glad for the short walk, gorging myself on the luxury of a few minutes of fresh, clean air. That's the worst and first hurdle over, I thought. The road ahead of me was wide and white with snow. It hung on the dull gray timbers and clung to the miles of tangled, gruesome barbed wire. There was fencing and barbed wire everywhere. A jungle of it flanked at intervals by looming, sinister, camouflage gun posts where armed British soldiers scanned the camp from perimeter to perimeter. It reminded me of a clip of a film I once saw when I was young of a Nazi concentration camp in winter. And I remember, although young, feeling shocked, but also secure in my chair by the fire, thinking that that type of place was a horror of the past, and I could not nor ever would be allowed or tolerated again, least of all in Ireland, and never upon me. I thought of families whispering together around the tables of the visiting room, the faces of mothers lined with sorrow, speechless fathers and crying, whimpering children, watching their daddies being bundled away by the monsters in black uniforms, the same heartless monsters who hung over your shoulder, listening to every word and syllable spoken, who kept your people queuing for hours on end for a half-hour visit, herding them about like cattle through one gate to the next, through one degrading, humiliating search to another, treating them like animals. They despised our people as much as they despised and hated us. They insulted them, harassed them, and broke their hearts by torturing their sons and daughters. I was naive when I was young. Here I was going back to a filthy concrete tomb to fight for my survival, to fight for my right to be recognized as a political prisoner of war, a right for which I would never stop fighting. The H block loomed up ahead of me on my right. I stood waiting for the gate to open, the gate to hell. A sinister silence reigned, not so much as a sign from the wind stirred. Not one bird sang, but there was nothing in Belson to sing about either, I thought, going through the gate to hell. I walked across the yard to the front door of the H block. On my left, the boys in the other wing were standing at their windows. The lights were on in a few cells. The rest of the cells were in darkness. Those cells with the lights on looked like little caves, the inhabitants wrapped in their shabby blankets. They were scary looking, their long beards and pale faces peering out at me from behind the concrete bars. I could see the slight movements of shadowy figures in the cells that were in darkness. "All right, Bobby," one of the boys shouted. I couldn't answer, so I waved back, feeling a little stupid. "Won't be long now," someone else shouted, and the boys began joking and staring at the windows. I looked to my right at the other leg of the H wing, which was my wing. There were no windows, not even a shadow of light to be seen. The entire outside length of the wing was shrouded with the corrugated iron and timber structure, which blocked out all light and view from the outside. Thank God they haven't gotten around to my side of the wing yet, I thought. They would soon. I entered the block and stood waiting by the iron grill gates, my unwanted barking escort disappearing. I was passed from one grill to the next until A appeared and admitted me back into my wing again. The high-pitched, whining, droning noise of the machine, which was sucking up the pools of urine still lying in the corridor, was echoing around the wing. The tea trolley was parked outside the search cell. I passed by it, noticing the coat of slimy skin that had formed upon the freezing cold tea. The slices of bread were piled high and were curled up and stale. The food lay on the plates. A piece of meat that represented a beef burger was almost surrounded, but not quite, by 20 or so beans. I walked on into the search cell, all thoughts of food disappearing. Disappearing in a flash as I saw C and D standing there. Walking ahead of my escort from the visit, I'd been able to move the parcel about in my mouth and swallow my spittle, but my throat was now parched again. I began to strip the clothes off me. 2 minutes and I would be safe. Just 2 more minutes. I took the trousers off and wrapped the towel around me. I no sooner had it around me when D said, "Drop your towel and turn around." I was waiting for the bending over bit. I dropped my towel and turned around, but to my surprise, nothing came. I grabbed my towel and rewrapped it around me, making for the cell entrance. That was it. I've made it or I haven't. I walked on out the door, still waiting for the words that would hail discovery, but they never came. I could barely believe my luck. A sniggered at me and said, "You'd be as well to take your tea back to your cell with you in case it gets cold." C and D found that very amusing. The hovering orderlies went into hysterics. I ignored them and took the plate and cup, noticing the meager contents. I walked on down the wing, which was by now dry at the end where I was walking. The screw with the machine was still working away at the far end and was almost finished. The drone was mind-racking, but I was happy as a lark. I couldn't wait to get back into my cell. I dreaded the thought, but it was purely to be able to spit out my well-traveled contraband. A opened the door, and I stepped back into the darkness of my filthy cold tomb. The door slammed behind me, and I stood in the darkness. Victory! I wish that I could have told them that I had outdone them. That I had put one over on them. Especially that bastard C. I could hardly believe that I had made it back safely. Yahoo! I set my cold tea on the floor and took the parcel out of my mouth. It was a relief. The wee parcel was wet and I dried it at the end of my towel.
makes it home just like 1981. For Ireland's bravest man, we must be united and manly on the stand. England, you're a monster. Don't think that you have won. Justice for the young lives and the way, for the rights as Irish soldiers and supreme her native land. They stood beside their leader, oh, the gallant Bobby Sands, proudly more music to lacking, bring a preach in our past hills. The narrow streets of Greenery, they miss O'Hara still. They so proudly gave her young lives some ring that's hung as old. The names will be remembered as history unfolds. So read the roll of honor for Ireland's bravest men. We must be united in manly heart and ten. England, you're a monster. Don't think that you have won. We will never be defeated. The black flags that sadly wave. She salutes 10 Irish martyrs, the bravest of the brave. John McConnell had to listen for a bit in the top of school. They gave their lives for freedom. With Thomas McElwain, on Michael Devine from Free Terry, you were the last to die. With your nine brave companions, with the martyr death you lie, your souls cry out, remember, our deaths were not in vain. So fight on and meet our the jail of hell to see. a man. Oh, can't she feel? Oh, can't she see?
By 1976, the conflict in the north of Ireland had claimed over 1,500 lives. In its war against the Republican movement, the British government's focus shifted to the prisons. All those convicted after 1st of March 1976 were to be treated as criminals and held in a new prison, the H Blocks.
They tried here to force the prison gear on me in the reception area. I resisted.
And he says, put the uniform on. And I said, not putting uniform on because I'm a political prisoner and not wearing no prison uniform.
It went without saying, Republican prisoners did not view themselves as criminals. Never did, and they never will.
Government standing against the wall and strip off and put my clothes under a brown bag and I'd strip down my underpants. And the guy came out again and says, I said strip, get the fucking heap off. So I stripped off naked through the underpants into the bag.
You were standing in the circle in front of all these screws, forces stripped naked, and you were just all the usual snide remarks, the jeers, the jokes, all the usual rubbish coming from.
There can be no question of political status for someone who is serving a sentence for crime. Crime is crime is crime. It is not political, it is crime.
The talk was that H3 was not the block to go to. If you could avoid H3, you'd be doing all right. I just heard them shouting, H3, and I just remember, oh God, you know. That's what I didn't want.
I was trailed by the hair, kicked into the classroom. I was stripped naked. They threw me a towel. They gave me a towel. And even when I was trying to walk with a towel, I kept pulling the towel off me when they'd bring me down to the cell.
I can remember walking down the wing and you feel very awkward for a start if you're walking with no clothes and no shoes on, so it's a bit awkward walking anyway. But the other thing was, you know, what do you do with your hands? Do you put them over your braves as if you're, then that feels as if you're embarrassed, you know, but at the same time you're not going to sort of march down the wing, you know, your arms are there because that's not how you're feeling either. So I remember sort of feeling, you know, your hands were like lumps of lead just by your side somewhere, you know.
Refusing to wear the uniform, the men wrapped themselves in blankets to hide their nakedness. And so began the blanket protest. It was to become one of the most remarkable prison protests in history. This is the story of the men who lived it, what gave them hope, how they lifted their morale, and what kept their spirits alive.
In the H Blocks, you were locked in a cell, and because you were a protesting prisoner at that particular stage, at the early stage of protest, you were able to get out of your cell and go to the toilet. That was about it. If you took a visit, you were able to get out of your cell. If you went to mass, you could get out of your cell. Other than that, we were confined to our cells 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, etc. So I remember, this is me. I mean, here, this is me, this is the H Blocks.
I think the first number of years, you're still very much ahead, still very much on the outside. So it's a Saturday night, you're thinking about what you would have been doing on a Saturday night or what your mates are now doing, or you'd be thinking about your family or what was going on there, or the places you would start to go because you're starting to hear new things and be curious about things. So now it's about also the things you would do which you never would have thought of when you're outside. So the outside world is a big occupation. I'd have paced up and down the cell for about 10 hours a day, and that's a, you know, that's a lot of time to be, and you're just thinking thoughts, imaginary thoughts. You're doing things about Irish and such like, but you'd end up, I suppose, holding totally imaginary conversations with different people, maybe people who are in the jail but you don't have access to, or people who are on the outside. So it's, yeah, in many ways, it's, you create a bit of an imaginary world in your head.
To defeat the system, they would need to be able to dictate the pace of the protest. Escalation was inevitable. Confined to their cells, the immediate enemy became the prison staff, and the authorities would seek every opportunity to undermine their spirit.
Food and tobacco were things that definitely affected the morale of the wing. The particular screw in charge of the wing, his policy was, well, there wasn't brutality it was to generally starve us. Like, the portions were just outrageous. You know, you could literally count the number of cornflakes on the bowl. The bowls themselves were smaller than in any other block. They were like saucers. So you could be counting. Somebody one morning shouted over, I think it was Sean Coleman, he had 11 cornflakes. And this was mixed with milk and water, you know, the water down the milk. In the evening, you got a cup of tea and cake, and it was just yellow cake that used to come round. That a lot of people hated, and it's funny because Kieran Docherty, who died in the hunger strike, used to be saying that anybody didn't want the yellow cake to swing it up to him. And at the time, there was no windows. It smashed the windows, and they were open, so you could... the bit of a towel that we used wasn't a towel, it was a piece of like a white linen, but you could use it to put your arm out and swing from one cell to another. So, like, people would actually swung down the yellow cake down to Big Duck. I think it was the idea of just having something to eat rather than nothing.
Amid a dispute over the issue of slopping out, the protest was to reach new levels as prisoners resorted to the drastic step of covering their cells in excreta. Their actions put the prison authorities on the back foot and boosted the prisoners' morale. They seemed capable of enduring even the most inhumane of living conditions.
There was different ways of just dumping it out the window. There was options of maybe leaving it lying in a pen in the corner. You had maggots and stuff like that there because of the good weather. You had food dumped in the corner, so bread, maggots, blue bottles and all that there. So we decided the only place to put it was on the wall. It meant that it dried quickly. It also meant that you had to break off a piece of your mattress. When your shit went on the wall. I mean, the most embarrassing thing for me personally was having to sit in a corner with another person, another male person, no less than 5 or 6 feet away from me. So what I did, and I just did it, I couldn't have done it any other way. When I needed to use the toilet, I brought my own mattress and sort of covered myself off and give myself a wee bit of privacy. And I also believed that was given the other person because going to the toilet, it's pungent, the smell straight away, you know, so you need to get to the toilet quickly, clean yourself and then get a piece of mattress broke off that's enough to put on without getting it all over your hands and get that up onto the wall ASAP. People start at different places. It would start up beside where they sleep with their head would be, so as it's done and dusted quickly, or they'd start away down at the far end beside the door. People put it on in big clumps, people spread it out, people did designs. There was loads of ingenuity around putting a piece of shit in the wall. It was hard to believe, like, and we got a bit of a laugh out of that, you know, when people told us about their artwork and stuff like that, and you sit and you pick out faces, you pick out figures. Loads of stuff like that happened, you know, and that was always a bit of cracking, you know, and then there was always a slagging about being in a cell with a countryman. You were in real deep trouble, you know, because they were big lads and they did big number twos and stuff like that there.
The administration responded by transferring prisoners to new wings in order to clean the dirtied cells. Once in the corridors outside their confinement, the prisoners were at their most vulnerable as a policy of brutalization was implemented. Through beatings, mirror searches, and forced washing, the strength of their will was pushed to the limit. The battle for political status was to be hard fought, with the authorities intent on breaking those who would not conform to the prison regime.
You could hear the boys getting beat, you could hear the squeeze, the kicking, the punching. I mean, the whole waiting for the game again, it was a whole psychological thing too, you know. Sometimes it wasn't as bad as you were hearing, but the screws were squealing and bawling, they were banging the grill, so you couldn't see what was happening.
People are panicking. It's a free-for-all. It's just, it's you and about 15 screws, and it's you getting from that wing to the other ring in one piece, and depending who's over the what screws over the mirror, you know, it depends on the beating you're going to get.
They had a mirror. They used to set it on the ground. They used to ask you to stand over the mirror. We refused, so they physically here put you over the mirror. They squatted you over it and pushed you down,
And you had these screws probing at you, and see, at the end of the day, to me, they were lowering themselves. I just said to myself, me, they're disgusting. They're worse than an animal. You know, they were trying to break me.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights froze me, in jails they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they palm me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me, materialists test me, pollution it chokes me, movies they joke me, politicians exploit me, city life that jades me, Hudson Bay fleece me, hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.